Welcome to the podcast of Lancaster Brethren in Christ Church, located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. LBIC is a community being transformed by the love of Jesus, sharing this love with all people. We want this podcast to be an extension of our community and a connection with familiar voices. Together, we want to think about how to follow Jesus in our particular moment. So enjoy the podcast. We're grateful to have you join us as a part of the LBIC family.
I am just really glad that Jesus taught using stories because I am a big fan of stories. And as I was planning over the past weeks to speak this morning, my mind kept pulling me back to this one story. So eventually, I hope you'll see the connection to the story, but I want you to sit back and relax and listen to a story because I have a story for you. And after the story, then I'll try to make that connection to the passage for today, and then we'll close with a song and communion like we normally do. So 1 year after Nate and I got married, we moved to Nairobi, Kenya, and he worked with Somali refugees there, and I was teaching at a Christian international school. Riel was born while we were there, and when she was 4 months old, Nate had to take a trip to Somaliland for about a week or so. And Riel, it's not any fault of her own, but she was an extremely colicky baby. And so I was rather nervous about being on my own in Nairobi. And Nate said, you know what, Jill, just fly to Lancaster and like introduce Riel. Just stay there for a week while I'm gone, and then you can come back and introduce Riel to your friends and family in Lancaster. So, you know, thinking this was a good idea, I booked a flight, and the trip actually went surprisingly well. You know, a four-month-old baby is not as bad as a toddler, I think, in a plane, maybe. So I wasn't really worried about the trip back to Nairobi. On the way to the Philadelphia airport, after my week at home, or I guess I have had two homes at this point, but on the way to the Philly airport, we drove through tons of like late, early summertime storms, you know, late June, you know, massive amounts of rain and thunder and lightning. But they had all cleared up and the sun was shining by the time we got to the airport and I said farewell to my parents. But as I walked to my gate, every single gate that I passed was full of people, like packed. There was not a seat in sight. And the woman at the counter told me, oh, all those storms, you know, they grounded all the flights for the past, you know, hour or so. So we're just really working to get everybody, all those previous outgoing flights, we're trying to clear the backlog. So you're definitely going to miss your connection in Brussels. So when you fly to East Africa, usually you're going to take, like you fly through, you always, almost always make a connection in Europe, especially if you get the cheaper flights like we did. So she said I was certainly going to miss my flight, but she typed on her little computer for a while, and she said, oh, but you know what? She said, I can get you in about 20 minutes. I can get you on this flight to Paris, and there you'll make a connecting flight to Nairobi, and it's going to actually get you there earlier than your original flight. And I was like, wow, that's great. Like, that sounds like really good news, right? And she said, your luggage might not make it, but it'll just, like, get there later on the other flight. And I was like, well, that's fine. I'm heading back to where I have lots of stuff anyway. So Riel and I, we make our way to the gate, and I got my little stroller, you know, everything. We get on the flight, and this is just so perfect. We have two seats to ourselves. I, like, lay here in the seat, and we're taxiing, and we're taxiing. And we turn and we taxi, and then we taxi some more. And just when I've decided that this pilot is planning to drive us to Paris, like we pull to the side, right? And yes, we are experiencing technical difficulties. So just hang on for a little bit. And in the meantime, they have these people who missed their flight. Like they're getting on the plane somehow. I don't even know. Like they add more people to the plane. And 3 hours later, we finally do take off. So it was now certain that I was going to miss my connecting flight in Paris as well. So at this point, the only thing I could do was basically like sit and enjoy the ride, right? You can't say like, get me off of here, I want my other one. So we land in Paris the next morning and we make our way to the airline office and the lady at the ticket office says, well, The next flight out isn't until this evening at about 6 or 7 p.m. And it's like 6 or 7 in the morning. So here's some vouchers for lunch. And here is a paper kind of explaining everything and your tickets for the next flight. We've booked you on the next flight this evening. And she hands me this paper that's like 5 feet long. It's like as tall as I am. And it has all these like things that I don't understand on it. I was like, oh, well, I'm sure the airline understands this. So I fold this up, put it in my bag. And I make sure I know where the check-in counter is. I like make sure I know exactly where I'm going. And Riel and I have a day to spend in the Paris airport. So we find a place for lunch. And I mean, I'm kind of ignoring the fact that Riel, this four-month-old baby, is like every now and then needing to be like bounced and jounced and like is crying or whatever. We just like, that's just in the background at this point. But we find a place to eat, and I get Riel settled in the booth. She likes to sleep on her stomach, so I get her settled in the booth beside me. And I'm just about to take a bite out of my hamburger when the waitress comes over and says, we have some unattended luggage or unclaimed luggage or whatever that's called outside in this section of the airport. And in a few minutes, if it's not claimed, we're going to have to evacuate this section of the airport. Okay, yep. We'll do this. And sure enough, she comes back and she says, yeah, it hasn't been claimed, so everybody has to get out. So I leave my burger. I wake up Riel, put her in the stroller. She's not happy. I like roll myself out. They're like rolling these big gates down. I've never experienced this before. They're rolling these big gates down to close this part of the airport. And so I make my way over to another section of the airport to wait out whatever thing they do with like checking if there's a bomb or whatever. And so I thought, okay, now's a good time. I'm going to update Nate on everything that's happening. And this was before like really consistent, you know, free Wi-Fi and phones that work internationally, those kind of things. So I find this kiosk, this like internet kiosk, and I'm like, you know, pushing the stroller like this, trying to keep Riel quiet, maybe use my foot, signing into Gmail. And like, sure enough, Nate is on Gmail chat. Okay. This is also the days of Gmail chat. And so I kind of update him, like, this is what's happening, like, this is crazy, and I can't get out until tonight, so the flight's going to be later. And he says, wow, that's awesome, you can explore Paris. A whole day. I type back to him, I would die. I was not into that. Anyway, I was not going to let that gate out of my sight, so I let him know what's happening, and you know, a section of the airport eventually opens, and I go back to my cold burger and try to eat a little bit of it, and then I basically like camp outside that gate and the check-in counter. And finally, you know, there's only so many like positions a four-month-old can have in your arms before your entire torso feels like concrete. But we made it. We made it. I kept telling Riel, like, we are not going to live in this airport. We will get home, okay? And I was basically just telling myself because four-month-olds don't really care. And I kept thinking of that movie Terminal for the guy who he's like flying and then suddenly he's flying home and the government in his home country collapses and then he basically has to live in the airport because his passport is invalid. Anyway, I knew that was not going to be me. That was not going to be me. So it's finally time to check in. I like take my stuff, hand the guy my 5-foot-long piece of paper, and he looks at it, and he's typing, and he looks at it, and he's typing, and then he's typing some more, and then he takes off his glasses, and he says, you have a reservation for this flight, but you don't have a ticket. I don't know, what does that mean? I said, I didn't even book this flight, the airline did it for me. He sighs like I'm the most annoying person in the world. And then he like types some more. And then he like whips off his glasses and walks away and he disappears for a couple minutes. And I'm like, oh, please, please, please fix this problem. And he comes back. He hands me my 5-foot-long piece of paper. And he says, I can't do anything for you. You have to call your airline. Okay. All right. I'm like, I'm ready. Okay. We've got like, what, 2-3 hours maybe before the flight leaves? And he's like, the phones are over there. So I like pack all my stuff. I go over to the phones and there's like, they're really complicated phones. They've got like directions in every language except for Spanish and English, which is like the two languages that I might possibly understand. But, and then they accept these like coins that I've never seen before. They're like ancient like French francs or whatever. No, I'm just making that up. But it was very, very confusing. The phones were not usable. So I turn around and I see this big orange sign that says info or information or something like that. So I'm like, oh yeah, there's a lady sitting there. Like, information, she can help me. So I march myself over to the info desk, and I just start talking. I tell her this whole long story, and I show her my big paper, and I tell her that I need to figure out how to call my airline and get this, I don't know, get this figured out. And she looks at me and she says, why are you here? This is airport's information. I don't know anything about your flights or about the airlines. I can give you airport information. Okay. I thanked her for playing into every stereotype I have of Parisians. And I decided, okay, I just have to get to the airline, like the office. Now, they are located on the exact opposite side of the airport. And the Paris airport, at least at this point in time, I don't know if they've redone it, but it was set up in this way where there's all these levels, and I had this stroller, so we would get to these levels, and there's these big posts that you can't get through. You'd have to wait for the elevator. So we like stand and wait for the elevator, then we go down the elevator, then we get to the, and then you have to go on this other level. So I have to wait for the elevator again. And basically, it took me a long time to get to the other side of the airport. And I get to the airline office, and it's closed. So then I'm like, well, there's gotta be like some sister airline or something. Like there's something. Like, why would they be closed if they have a flight going out? So I'm like, I'm wandering around all these airline offices trying to find anybody who would like even have any remote idea what this 5-foot-long piece of paper says or how I can get anywhere. And I finally like spew my whole story again to the ladies at the Air France counter because they looked nice and they weren't busy. And this one lady, I think probably because I was about to be a puddle of tears on the floor, she was like, come with me. And so I follow her, and we walk, and we walk, and we walk, and we walk. And she takes me to the Brussels airline office. And she talks to the guy there for a while, and he says, you? He looks at me. He says, you? Sit down. I'm going to work on this. And so I sit down, and he's typing and typing and typing, you know. 45 minutes later, it's very clear that I've already missed my flight. 45 minutes later, he comes to me and he says, okay, there are no more flights out tonight, and there's none tomorrow. He said, but I can get you on a flight tomorrow morning at 4:45 a.m. to Zurich, Switzerland. And then it's a really short layover, but you can get yourself on a flight then in Zurich to Nairobi. And here's some vouchers for dinner. And here, this is the hotel you're going to stay at tonight. And this is the tram you're going to take to get there. And here you go. Okay. We take the tram. We take the vouchers. We get dinner. We check into the hotel. They give me like what looks like a laundry cart for Riel to sleep in. And I was like, forget that. It was like, yeah, it was really a laundry cart. We get to sleep maybe by like midnight. I'm not sure. But I was really afraid at this point that I was going to miss my alarm or something, or the hotel was going to burn down or something. I don't know. And so we get up at 3 in the morning and we make our way back on the tram back to Paris airport, and we check in and we get on the flight to Zurich. For some reason they didn't check my stroller at the gate, they checked it the whole way through, and so I was like, I'll just carry her. And so I have like this sleeping dead weight in my arm, and we have to go from the wherever we were across the Zurich airport to the other side where the international transfers were. And I'm like booking it as fast as I can, like dragging all my stuff. And we get there, and they're making the last call for boarding the flight to Nairobi. And we finally sit down on that flight. And I don't breathe again until we are solidly in the air. There was a very sweet Indian family behind me who held Riel for about half an hour on the flight. And they were like, oh, we have a 4-month-old at home. And it was around the time, I guess it was the time of the World Cup. This was a Swiss Air flight, and they had these little Swiss chocolates. It just felt like heaven. It really felt like I had landed in heaven, and I was still in the air. But We finally landed in Nairobi after 52 hours of transit. And once you know it, but there's my luggage, beat me to Nairobi, waiting for me at the unclaimed luggage counter. So I tell you this story because I want to convey to you that feeling of a complete lack of control in a situation. I was at the mercy of what felt like some unseen force, right? There was really, it's a feeling of total vulnerability. I was at the mercy of those airlines and what they could find for me when everything I know or have planned for or everything that I've trusted up to this point has been stripped away. And really, this happens in life, right? I think that anyone who has had a cancer diagnosis knows what I'm talking about. For that matter, anyone who has had any kind of health complications, you know what I'm talking about. Anyone who is getting old, you know what I'm talking about. When what we know and what we've trusted and what we've understood to this point is getting stripped away. Anyone who experiences anxiety or other mental health complications, who has experienced family crisis, a faith crisis, or has lost a job, everything that we've built, everything that we understand is being stripped away. Those of us who feel like our marriage might not be what we thought it would be, or that our children aren't the way that we thought they would turn out, or that we would be married at this point in life, but we're not. We are people of faith, and we often call this feeling of vulnerability and lack of control, we call it a desert. We often refer to it as like a desert time, probably because we're referring to the Israelites when they were in captivity in Egypt, in slavery in Egypt. And they're finally freed, right? They get their freedom from slavery, but they wander in this wilderness, in the desert, for 40 years, making mistakes and forgetting to trust God and complaining about the fact that this is not the freedom or the promise that they thought, or the promised land, you know? But wow, they sure learned a lot during that time about God and about his love for us, and we, to this day, are still learning from their stories and from their experiences. So Richard Rohr puts it this way. People of faith are the ones who expect the promises of their deepest soul to be fulfilled. Life for them becomes a time between promise and fulfillment. It is never a straight line, but it is always three steps forward and two backward. And the backward creates much of the knowledge and impetus for the forward. The backward creates the knowledge and the impetus for the forward. We will find that the desert is not all desert. The way to the promised land leads to life even in the midst of the desert. Jesus can use that time, our time in the desert, our time in the wilderness, that experience of vulnerability and lack of control, to say to us, I am here. You are not alone. And that's what brings me actually to the passage for today in Mark. Jesus is in his hometown, right? A place of comfort, a place that he is known. But he experiences this vulnerability, you know, because the people he has known all of his life, they sort of reject him. It says they took offense at him. Isn't this the guy, the carpenter's son? Like, this is the guy we know. Like, who is he? And then he turns around, though, and he tells his disciples, he takes them and he says, I'm sending you on a journey. I want to send you out. You can go two by two, go with another person, but take nothing for that journey except for a staff. Take no bread, no bag, no money. Wear sandals, but not an extra shirt. Whenever you enter a house, you stay there until you leave that town. And we usually look at this passage from an evangelism perspective, like going out and telling people the good news. But I wonder if Jesus also is offering them an opportunity to experience this vulnerability, right? To everything they know, everything that they trusted in, the comforts of life are being stripped away. And he's preparing them to feel and to know his presence even when he's not with them. To be clear, suffering and difficulty are not like of the Lord, or they're not from God, or they're not inflicted by God. And neither should we ignore justice or good sense. There's plenty of times when we should be fighting and working hard against the injustices of this world. But I'm talking about that inevitable pain in life. When we encounter this kind of vulnerability, the stripping away of what we know and have taken for granted, there is a way of dwelling with Christ in the midst of it. We all have to turn to God and let ourselves be led on this faith journey. We have to be willing to experience the exodus in our own lives, to let God take us from captivity to freedom, from Egypt to Canaan, from Lancaster to Nairobi, not fully knowing how to cross that desert or that ocean in between. When everything else is stripped away, all we are left with is Jesus. As we get ready for communion, we're going to have a song and then we'll take communion together, but I have one last thought for some reflection. My cousin's 18-year-old son was recently diagnosed with a very aggressive brain tumor. And I want to close with an excerpt from one of their posts on Caring Bridge. This is Lynn speaking. I woke up thinking about prayer. There have been so many beautiful expressions of prayer, and I'm trying to figure out how to pray right now and what prayer is for. Pain and deep pain is part of life, and there's no reason we deserve it any more or any less than anyone else. There's no reason we deserve to have access to world-class medical care when most people in the world simply do not. I don't think prayer is to get God to do what we want, but to get beyond ourselves and into connection with God and others, to remember that we are loved and held no matter what happens, to remember that we are not in control, to notice every gift we are given with gratitude, to know that we are not the center, but we are just as important as every other point in the web, and that we are not alone.